everyone. I'm Haley Allam, and this is Mom Life in Luxembourg. If you're a parent new to Luxembourg, then this is the podcast for you. From crèches to crèmes, we'll cover everything you need to know about raising kids and living your best life in the Grand Duchy. Hi, Paulina. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Hi, Haley. So nice to be here today.
I'm so excited to have you because you're talking about something that I know absolutely nothing about. That is the attachment theory. But I also want to talk about you being a doula and what that's like in Luxembourg. I didn't have a regular doula. I didn't have a postpartum doula. I was pregnant in Dubai and in the States. And I just recently interviewed Maud, who is a content creator behind you.r.family. Shout out to anyone who is listening to these, maybe not in order, because I think hers will come out first. She gave us a very personal experience about what it's like to have a baby here in Luxembourg. Also, she suffered from postpartum depression. That episode's all about that. But I think you found me and reached out. You're hosting this amazing event. By the time this episode comes out, it's going to have already passed, but it's all about the fourth trimester. Before we talk about you being a doula, what attachment theory is, and the fourth trimester in general, tell me a little bit about you, your story, right. Your Luxembourg story.
I moved for work to Luxembourg in 2017, and I was young and single, and I was like, almost like, where is Luxembourg? What do you mean it's not by the sea kind of thing? I was here for half a day for the interviews and then they hired me and there I was.
And you're from originally Russia?
I'm originally from Moscow, and they were looking for somebody that would have international experience and that would have experience in my field and that would somebody who would want to come to Luxembourg. So that was kind of like the stars aligned and there I was.
I think you might be the first person I've ever interviewed that moved here single. And youngish.
Define youngish. I moved in 2017. I wasn't young in Russia. If you're not married by 30, that means you're not young.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
So yeah, the very different scene. I moved here for work and then I met my husband here, who is French. This will play interestingly into attachment theory later on, the reason that he's French. And I wasn't, you know, I was dating internationally. So for me, it wasn't a big deal that he was French, but I did not realize how culture plays into being parents and how to raise your kids and how opinions are so very different. It's amazing.
Yeah. I have a husband who is Lebanese.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
He's technically American, but he's Lebanese Italian. We definitely have different cultural backgrounds, and that comes out in our child rearing for
sure. Family in-law opinions? Are they big on the table?
Yes. And they're all listening to this. So that's all I'm going to say about that. But Right. Yes, definitely different.
Amazing people, I'm sure.
They are. But, you know, actually, I did do an episode with an expat. I think she's a psychologist, but she really dives into the intricacies of a cross-cultural marriage and the strengths and the challenges and stuff like that. Okay, so back to you.
Right, so we got married, then COVID happened, and I got pregnant right in COVID. We had our first baby. I mean, my life before, so I was in spirits marketing. I was, you know, you ask me the top five cocktail bars in the world, I'll tell you where to go and what to order.
Amazing. I want to be your friend.
Yeah, we can do that later on.
After the show.
I still know my way around single malt. So I'm a fun party guest.
From spirits marketing to doula?
To doula, right.
I love the pivot.
Yeah, from happy hour to golden hour, as I called it once in one of my posts. And when I got pregnant, the hormones, they just like took over me. And I have a friend who's a perinatal psychologist, and she was like, yeah, here's the reading list. Look this up, read this up. And, you know, I started to do exactly that. And I just fell in love with the concept. Well, I didn't fall in love with the concept, but I felt so bad that the way our bodies are meant to give birth has nothing to do with hospital births of today.
Yeah, I have some feelings about that.
Yeah, I bet you do. And like when my first pregnancy was kind of crap because my waters broke at 21 weeks and I was in bed rest in CHL.
Oh, and from 21 weeks you were at CHL?
Right? Yeah, I was in bed rest. Yeah. So the viability age here in Luxembourg is 24 weeks. So up until 24 weeks, if something happens, they basically can't do anything. And from 24 weeks, slowly, the percentage of success goes up. But yeah.
Do you know why your water broke at 20 weeks?
No idea. And I looked at it through so many ways that physiologically, there's no explanation.
Wow.
Yeah. Apart from nothing. I wasn't working at that point. It was a Saturday morning. I was at home cooking something and like, there's something runs down my leg. I'm like, oh, this is funny. I wonder what it could be. And then we just, instead of going to the pharmacy to get one of those amniotic fluid tests, we just went to see a child just because it's Luxembourg, everything's 10-minute ride. And we, and they said, well, you're not going anywhere today and don't Google anything. I didn't. My husband did. He lost 2 kilos by Monday. It was Saturday.
Are you telling me that you had to stay at CHL for 20 weeks?
For 10 weeks, yeah.
Oh, because you delivered at 30 weeks?
Yeah, 31.4. Yeah, because so basically when your waters break, it's a waiting game. Almost 90% of cases finish within 48 hours, irrelevant to what stage the waters break. So I was so mega lucky.
So they probably thought that this baby was not going to make it.
Yeah, no. At the end, they told me, well, we didn't think you're going to be here for so long. We're so happy for you. But like, we were afraid even to go into your room because this is not a happy story. But, you know, the thing that really saved me was, I'm overall a quite positive person the way I think about things. But like a few days before, I read that amniotic fluid replenishes itself.
Oh, you just happened to read that?
Yeah, well, I was already in the subject, right? I was reading books and all these things around pregnancy. And it's like, well, every amniotic fluid replenishes because the baby drinks it and then pees it out. And then, you know, then your body makes more amniotic fluids. I'm like, it's fine, you know, it's just going to make more. I got really scared a week later when we had the ultrasound and they saw it, like how little water was left.
Oh.
Yeah. It was like a few millimeters and the doctor started crying.
Oh my God.
Well, no, she didn't. Well, yeah, she kind of did.
So you had like a traumatic kind of pregnancy.
Yeah.
And a premature baby.
Yeah.
And so that had turned you from spirits marketer to doula?
I think it's the hormones more than that. But I think it made me see the system a lot closer up than mm-hmm. I would have because I spent so much time. Because, you know, when you're on bed rest, you get visits from the sage-femmes. From the midwives 3 times a day, so they come in to check in on you. The doctors are there every day to speak to you. So I was like, oh, what do you think about doulas? Oh, what do you think about this? Mm. Oh, is like, because it was, he was in Siege, so he was in a position that normally they don't like to deliver.
Breech,
yes. And I was like, oh, is there an option to do a soft cesarean? And like, I would be shocked by the answer. But yeah, for me, it was, you know, if I compared myself to, this would have happened to me in Russia, I would have been in a room of, might have been 6 people, might have been 20 women for like the same amount of time.
Oh, because you wouldn't get your own room?
No. It's very different.
I don't know anything about healthcare in Russia.
It used to be public. It's more 100% public. Now you get more private. But with cases like this, you go to the first hospital that's available. So by coincidence, my sister-in-law went through the same in 2014.
Wow.
So her waters broke when she was at 28 weeks and she delivered at 30. So we already had a preemie in our family and they had succeeded to breastfeed. He was healthy. I could see him, you know, this was a case in my family. And for me, I was scared up until 24 weeks. And then every morning I'd wake up and I'd say, oh, I didn't give birth tonight. Oh, that's great. So yeah. Cause they said, well, most likely labor will start at night. So, you know, if you wake up in the morning, nothing's happened. It's a good day.
Wow.
And I had Wi-Fi. My husband was there every day. I had a TV. I had books.
Did your own room?
Yeah, I had my own room.
Which I think, important for people who are listening, you only get your own room if you have private insurance on top of CNS.
Yes. And I was lucky because my private insurance did not kick in. Because, you know, I was planned to deliver in April. And there I was on the 4th of December. And my private insurance would have kicked in like the 1st of March. But the good thing about CHL is their double rooms are much less available than their single rooms. So I think they have 2 per floor. So when I came in, all their double rooms were taken. So they put me in a single room.
Oh.
And then by the time that they were like in a month, oh, you're here for a while now. We need to move you on. And I cried and begged them, please, please, please leave me.
Wow.
And they did. And they were so kind. I'm still grateful to this day to the people that made this decision, because if you're in a double room, your husband can't stay the night. I mean, he stayed once a week, but still, you know, the emotional impact of having other babies in your room, other women who are in labor in your room.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah. So I'm forever grateful to CHL for making that happen. But yeah, it was 10 weeks. It was COVID, nothing to do outside. The weather was bad. You know, we got food delivered. It was not, I mean, comparison to normal life in Luxembourg,
it was okay.
It was okay. Yeah.
That's CHL here in the city.
Yeah, CHL. So you have 4 maternity hospitals in Luxembourg in the country. You have 2 in the city, which is CHL, which is the government one. And you have the one in Kirchberg here. That's the Boller, which is the private hospital. Then you have one in the north in Etelbruck, and you have one in Esch.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you've had the baby and you've made the decision that you want to become a doula?
Yeah. Yeah. So I was doing courses while I was at the hospital.
Wow.
Yeah, online, because everything's online. You can do online now.
So on bed rest,
yeah.
You're like, I think.
What else is there to do?
I don't know. Well, I probably wouldn't have been so productive, I don't think.
Because I'm a Gemini. I think, you know, I process things while doing things. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's hard for me to stop.
I also am a Gemini.
Oh,
yes.
Twin soul.
Okay, so what does a doula actually do?
So the thing is that when you come into a hospital setting to give birth, everybody's looking out for you medically. But birth is such an emotional, it's such a primal state that the more comfortable you feel, the better the outcome is. So a doula is there to make sure you feel comfortable, whatever that means. Is that making sure you're physically comfortable or emotionally comfortable or informationally comfortable, understanding what's going on? What are they doing? What are they suggesting? Explaining things to you, like not actually like helping you understand. So you, because, you know, birth can, you've given birth three times. I don't know what your stories are, but were they all linear? Did they all go the way you planned them to?
No.
Yeah, that
short story. No,
yeah, that happens a lot.
I also though feel that in the States, once you arrive at the hospital and they keep you there, admit you, you're on the train, like you're on the baby train, yeah. And you might have had all these plans or hopes or desires, and that's just too bad because like you're getting
it's
that
a business.
Yeah, like you're getting that Pitocin whether you want it or not. You know, you're on the clock. Once your water's broken, you're really on the clock. And so I don't know if having a doula would necessarily do anything. But what I think what I remember about doulas was like, if you don't want an epidural, you should get a doula because they like try to convince you that you don't really need one.
Well, a doula, I mean, it's every woman's choice how to deliver. And if you want an epidural, you should definitely get one. There is information saying that epidurals aren't that great for the baby, aren't great for yourself down the road. But overall, doula is there to support you in any way you want. And if you don't want an epidural, there are ways how to live through pain without suffering. We know how to help you. So whether that's movement, whether that's massage, whether that's talking to you, there's a lot of things we could do.
You're a postpartum doula, right?
Yes, my interest. So overall, why I focus on postpartum is because the local Luxembourgish system, the doctors, they don't like having doulas in the room. And for example, in Kirchberg, if you say you're a doula, they won't let you in.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, because they think we're interfering. And well, actually, by providing this additional support, we're alleviating work from midwives because I'm not a medical professional. I didn't go to medical school. I cannot and I don't want to do their job, but I'm there to support the woman.
And the midwife is also in the room?
So the doctor is in charge of the birth. So once a woman is inside the labor ward, she is tracked by the doctor with the hands of the midwife. So a lot of the times the midwife calls the doctor to kind of align on the route, on the plan of action, but she would do that for the doctor. And then the doctor arrives if there's something that's not right or if the baby's almost there at the pushing stage. Normally the doctor arrives at the pushing stage. And the midwife, she tracks several labor wards at the same time, right? So she's in and out. And she sees, of course, she sees your data because you have the CTG on you and she knows, you know, your basic medical history and all this. And of course, you know, they're super nice here. They're so attentive to you because in a lot of countries like Soviet Union, where my mother gave birth to me and, you know, the post-Soviet mindset is very different. Obstetric violence is a big thing. In a lot of countries is a big thing. In Luxembourg, it's different, right? There's very little harshness in the room. There's very little violence in the room. But
what is obstetric violence?
Oh, when they're nasty to you when you're giving birth. I didn't give birth anywhere but Luxembourg. But a lot of the stories that I hear and I know and from my friends, it's like they're not there to be kind to you. They say nasty things. They make fun of you when you're in pain. They can, you know, and apart from doing medical things you don't agree to, that's also obstetric violence. But that's a heavy subject. And in Luxembourg, I would say that it exists everywhere because we're all human, right? But here it's less prevalent and it takes on a different color. It's more like condescending and like, oh, do you really think you have a choice? Kind of like that. And like it's innuendos.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's, I mean, you don't want that in any way format. But a lot of the times as well, women come in not knowing what labor is like, not educating themselves on what their experience can be. That's why, you know what, my friend, a thing that really shocked me, my perinatal psychologist friend, what she said, like, guess the number of women that actually educate themselves on birth before having a baby.
I mean, 100?
Percentage, like how many percent of women actually like read up on birth before they give birth?
What kind of person would not read up on birth?
4% of women read up and educate themselves on birth. 4%.
Only 4%?
I was shocked. How is this possible?
Yeah. And also, how do they really know? Because for example, I tried to read up, but it didn't prepare me at all.
Yeah, that's it. But there's more now, I think, with the age of social media and people like these educators being more social media savvy and being more engaging in the way they present their information, it's become much more available. Mm. And it, because like I have friends who have given birth 10 years ago, 15 years ago, like even, no, 5 years ago already, it was pretty much out there. But like they didn't have the same depth of knowledge that I could get just because I knew where to, who to read to and who to listen to.
Mm, who to follow, et cetera.
Yeah, who to follow.
Okay, let's get to the, yeah, the postpartum.
So when I, the thing that really got me is that, okay, you have this birth education, you have these amazing books. And the thing is like, you have the baby and it's just one day out of your life. But then it's like having the wedding and the marriage, mm-hmm. right? And the postpartum, can, you know, how long does postpartum last? Depending on who you ask.
Are you asking me?
Well, yeah. Tell me, how long did your postpartum last?
Well, I think the worst, like I remember just like trying to count the days till like it was 6 weeks.
Yeah.
Because I thought it would get less bad after 6 weeks. I don't know. I've been in a fog for like 10 years.
Oh man, yeah. Yeah, because your brain does change. Your brain technically changes. It gets rewired. Certain things, certain parts get smaller, certain parts get bigger. But like, have you heard about the concept of matrescence?
No.
No. Do you know about adolescence?
Adolescence, childhood. Yes.
Yes. When a child becomes an adult, the process, the teenage years are technically adolescence.
Okay.
So it's a number of years where hormones just make you into a new person, right? Well, into from a child into an adult. So matrescence is the same, but from when a woman becomes a mother. Because if you look at the load of hormones that go through your body at the same time, it's like the same amount. It's not less. And all the ancient cultures, and still some cultures like the Chinese today, they honor this and it's a rite of passage. And like, it doesn't finish with, you know, taking the baby in your arms and walking out of the hospital, but it takes a few years for you to grow into it.
Wow.
Because the hormones, they don't stop at birth, right? Like there's this, you know, the first postpartum period, let's say the first 40 days where it's pretty much wild, but then it doesn't stop because if you keep breastfeeding, if you keep being in contact with your kids, which, you know, you normally do, your brain evolves because the hormones of prolactin and oxytocin that go through your body when you contact with your babies, with your, well, with your kids when they grow up, they do things to you. That's why grandmothers are kinder, because they've had more impact of these hormones through their years.
Wow.
I'm generalizing, of course, but yeah.
Wow. Yeah. Never heard of this.
Yeah.
Never heard of this.
We don't give women enough grace. We don't give them enough attention. We don't give, don't take care of them in the way they should be taken care of. Because you look at, if you look at all the other, at the history of mankind, having a baby was not done alone in isolation as an expat with you in a nuclear family with only your husband to, like, you know, do the dishes and feed you sometimes.
And you're just trying not to kill him.
Yes. Yes. Because men were not meant to do this. Originally, men were not meant to be there. They're meant to make the baby, go hunt, come back, bring the food. You're all taking care of your, it's the women of your tribe that took care of you.
Wow. Okay. A postpartum doula is the tribe?
Yeah. Well, it's part of the tribe. Yes. So a postpartum doula, somebody would come to your house and whatever you need help with the baby or with the house or with the household members, she could do that for you. From cooking postpartum dishes to helping out figuring life with the baby, because, you know, how many people have seen a newborn, not like even thinking spending how many times, how many hours you spent with a newborn before you've had your own baby. Unless you're a nurse in the maternity ward, probably close to zero, because, mm-hmm. you know, we live a life, we have jobs, we don't see newborns every day. Yeah, like figuring out your house, even like helping with a little cleaning, but generally making you feel better in this very, very raw period of just having your baby.
So someone who you can trust that you don't have to like clean up your house and look good for.
Somebody,
like,
will come and clean the house for you.
You hold the baby while I take a shower, and then I'll hold the baby and you clean my house.
Exactly. Yeah. So the ideal postpartum, if you like look at all these cultures and stories and all this, is the woman gives birth and then she stays in bed for 40 days. And then people, women come and cook for her and bring her soup to her bed and help her with the baby and see if the baby's latching well. And then like sitting there talking, because one of the biggest things that we as women do, I don't know if you know, but we talk a lot. And processing this birth, processing what's happening to her, having women around her is just, it's such a big part of postpartum that being an expat, we don't get, because our tribe is so far away. And I remember, like, well, everybody has a special relationship with their mother. I mean, some more special, some others less. I didn't, you know, it was okay. But when I had Victor and when I was sitting there pumping at 7 a.m., because he was a neonat, you know, you don't stay the night there in NICU, I had to call my mother physically. I was an urge from deep inside me. Like, I have to call her and talk to her and tell her how the day went. It brings out emotions for your bloodline, your female bloodline you didn't know before. And it's natural.
Wow, this is so interesting.
Yeah.
So if you're pregnant in Luxembourg, obviously, and you know you're going to have a baby, how do you find a doula for the fourth trimester? Is that something that your OBGYN can refer you to groups?
Oh God, no. No, they don't. They don't.
No.
No, that's not something that they want. But you can do Google people like myself, and I know a few other wonderful ladies that do this. Good thing to do would be to ask in the Facebook groups that you follow. And if you don't follow any, follow Mama Facebook groups in Luxembourg, because that's very much alive.
What are your top Facebook Mama groups?
So the first one I joined, thanks to a friend who's had two babies before me, Lux Mamas. It's very vibrant and alive, and I think 10,000 followers.
Okay.
Then there's Ladies of Luxembourg. It's not technically a mama group, but there's a lot of motherhood questions. Then Moms of Luxembourg as well is another one.
Okay.
Yeah, and then of course the ones by language are really great as well, because when you have a baby, you realize how much culture goes into becoming a mother and raising babies.
Okay.
Yeah. And you only realize that, you know, when you're into it, because when you're knee deep in it, because there are certain things that are ingrained in how you do things and then, or how you've seen things done with your family or with friends. And then when you get weird comments or things that you didn't expect hearing, you're like, wait, where did this come from?
Does that bring us to attachment theory and the cultural differences between Russia and French mom and dad?
Yes, yes. So when I was pregnant, when I was like before I was in the hospital, I read this book called Bringing Up Bebe.
I read that book, I think.
Yeah, by Pamela Druckerman.
It's about an American and her kids don't eat chicken nuggets and stuff because they grew up in France and they have a good palate.
Yes, so that's the good part of that. So yeah, she's an American that moved to Paris and had three kids there. Now, she wrote that book, I don't know, maybe 15 years ago, a while ago. So it's been even translated into Russian. And all my Russian friends already read it by the time that I read it. And I was like, oh my God, that's so amazing. Because she's an American, she's looking outside into the French culture. And of course, she notices things that other people wouldn't. And she's like, oh my God, they don't put such weight in breastfeeding because, you know, why break your head if it's not working for you? And look, their babies are so well behaved and so well trained because they sleep train them and the baby sleeps through the night at 2 months and how great that is. And of course she goes through like the whole culture, the whole spiel, and they have some really good parts about the nuggets and about, you know, how they treat kids from the beginning as humans, right? They say hello to them no matter what their age is and, you know, and all that. So there's good parts to it. But when I read it, I'm like, oh, it's so simple. Look, I'm married to a French man. This is what I'm going to do. We're so close to France. I have a French mother-in-law. Perfect. You know, this is how it's supposed to be. And I had a few friends and were like, but you plan on breastfeeding, right? And I'm like, yeah, I am. But how do you think the baby sleeping in a separate room from the beginning is going to help you breastfeed? I'm like, oh, I don't know. Cause you don't connect the dots, right? You just look at that. And then the more pregnant I became and like when, you know, the baby was there and I was doing all these things and knowing what I know now. And I was like, oh my God. This is so unnatural. And this is where the culture comes into play. So a lot of the conversations that we have, we also run Mama Meets together with my friend who's a breastfeeding consultant, who I met when I couldn't breastfeed Victor. And she was there to support me and we succeeded in the end. Anyway, so we became good friends. Is we talk about the differences of culture versus nature, where a lot of the decisions where attachment theory comes in is that attachment theory follows nature. So one, it's easier for you, but also...
You should probably start with what attachment theory is.
Yeah, what is attachment theory? Let's put it this way. Attachment theory is how humankind lived before the advent of capitalism.
Oh, okay.
Like I wouldn't... Okay, not the advent, maybe further on. So attachment theory is how a lot of the tribes live now. Like if you look at people who are close to hunter and gatherers, or sometimes we call them third world countries...
Okay.
So what do? They breastfeed, they sleep with the baby, they carry the baby as much as possible. They try to understand the baby's cries, right? So they are very much in close contact with the baby. And what modern history has told us when, you know, they started doing research, psychology research, there was this American psychologist, Bowlby, who did this experiment on ducks. I don't know if you've heard about it, but he was the first person that ducklings saw when they hatched, and then they thought he was the mother. They would follow him around. So that's the kind of the bonding, the imprinting happened to them. So for humankind, for when a baby is born, they have certain signals that they follow for them to form this attachment to their mother. So when the baby is born, ideally, right? So the baby's on the belly and then it crawls up and takes the breath and it looks at you. And then through the skin-to-skin contact, through the golden hour, through breastfeeding, because your breast secretes a certain odor that's similar to the amniotic fluid, that's how the baby knows where to go. Because their eyesight isn't that great, but their sense of smell is very strong, even at birth. And then, you know, being in close contact with the baby, even when they're sleeping, even carrying them in a carrier, in a sling, just being close to them bodily, like feeding the animal need of closeness, helping them in that very raw period of just after being born to acclimatize to the outside world is a base for their mental health down the road.
And there's studies that show this is evidence-based.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
That like if you're a mom that wore your kid more instead of pushing him around in the pram, that kid's going to grow up to be better adjusted.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, yes, that's one of the things baby wearing. But it's like it's an array of things of co-sleeping, baby wearing, breastfeeding, and listening to the baby. Because you know that there's like even a newborn language that has five sounds of a newborn that were identified a few years ago, actually quite a few years ago now, but it's called the tongue-tongue language. And by listening to what sound the baby's making, you can say if it's hungry, if it's sleepy, if it's dirty, if it needs to burp, or if it has a tummy ache.
Wow. So you can come into someone's house with a newborn and listen to the baby's cries.
Yes.
That's so cool.
Yeah. It was an opera singer. I think she was either from Australia or New Zealand, and she had a baby, and she's like, oh, but I see a pattern in these sounds. And of course she has a musical ear, and
wow. Why does not everybody know this?
Yeah, I know, right? Uh-huh. This is, everybody should know this.
Yeah, the co-sleeping thing. So when I was giving birth for my first one, they were like, put the fear of God in me that if the baby slept on its stomach, it was going to die. If I co-slept, I was going to roll over them and kill them in the night. And I had the worst time. He was the worst sleeper. It was awful, 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 awful. And like all of my instincts were telling me to let the kid sleep with me, let the kid sleep on his stomach, all that. And he did not sleep through the night. So I had the baby in California and then I moved to Dubai. Well, went home to have the baby in California. We were living in Dubai technically. After 3 months, I flew back and my mother-in-law, who's Lebanese, came to visit. And, you know, I was like, not all there, you know, like he's not sleeping. And she flipped him on his stomach and he slept through the whole night.
Yeah.
And I was but by that point it had been 3 months and I was so exhausted and she had four kids and none of them died, you know, so I listened to her.
Yeah.
And with my second and third, oh my God, I co-slept, stomach. I broke every rule.
Oh, I love that for you. Amazing. You learn well.
Well, yeah, but I feel really bad about.
If you look into the research, right, there's a lot of good evidence that co-sleeping is natural. One of them that you and me are here today. Because if you look at how humankind lived up until, I don't know, 100, 150 years ago, even look at some cultures today, you know, Japan co-sleeps until kids are teenagers.
Oh,
do you know that Austria, they sell family beds? If you go into any furniture site from Austria, you will find an option of a bed like easily over 2 meters long, wide.
Wow.
Yeah. Many cultures co-sleep. I mean, I'm also third world countries where they don't have an opportunity to put the bed somewhere else in another room because they all sleep in the same room. And the story with co-sleeping is that there are certain rules you have to follow for it to be safe. Like having a hard bed so the baby doesn't kind of go into, get squished into the mattress, making sure your hair is tied up so that the baby doesn't roll itself. There are certain positions that are really great for co-sleeping.
Mm.
Also like making sure that there are no narrow spaces around the bed so that the baby doesn't roll into them. But they're pretty simple to follow. It's not like, it's not rocket science. You don't need to buy anything for more than €1,000 to do it. I'm actually mocking this new now, which is
I was just about to say there was a thing that does like this rocking thing.
No.
Yeah, and I was too cheap to buy it.
You did well because one, it's like it's a mama replacement. Is that a good thing or not? A mama replacement?
Well, I think it depends how exhausted you are.
Well,
right?
If you co-sleep, then you're much less exhausted.
Yeah, that's true for sure. Because you don't have to get up and walk to wherever you're going.
No. And the baby doesn't have to scream for so long for you to wake up and hear him.
Mm-hmm. What about what do you call those sleep nurses? They come and they take your baby at night so you can sleep.
Yeah. Do you want to breastfeed or not? That's my question.
I did.
Yeah. If we have a night nurse, then your breastfeeding journey will be much shorter because breastfeeding works in a 24-hour cycle and your breast milk, the signal that your baby needs milk comes at night from 3 a.m. to 5 a.m. So you need to latch the baby in that hour for your body to produce prolactin for you to have milk the next day.
Mm.
And if you don't stimulate your breastfeeding in that, you know, very, very early hour, then your supply goes down because the body is very smart. It doesn't do things it doesn't need to, right?
I actually, now that you mention it, so with my third, I got a night nurse because I had two kids already.
Yeah.
And like, they got to get up and go to school. And there was a 6-year gap. And my husband was like, we're throwing money at this problem.
Yeah. Yeah. And he'd, yeah.
But I would wake up actually and pump and just leave the bottles or something. I can't even remember. I would pump and then go back to sleep, but I didn't have to do the diaper. I didn't have to really get up. Or I would wake up and my boobs would be like exploding.
Yeah.
But I was also turning 40. So I was like, you know, this kid's getting the least amount of breast milk because I'm not sticking this out. My goal was to breastfeed each kid for a year, which, by the way, I got flack for also.
Oh man, people are so mean. How long did you breastfeed your last one?
6 months.
6 months. Good. Mm-hmm. It's good.
I mean, I turned 40, and actually what happened was I came here on my reconnaissance mission.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, you can't come from California here for like a day. So then I was pumping and then I couldn't keep up with it. And then I felt like mastitis was happening. And I was like, okay, so it was I even knew, I said, when I turned 40, I'm not breastfeeding anymore because I'm 40 and I don't want to do it.
Well, I had my second baby when I was 41 and I'm still breastfeeding her. She's two. She was two yesterday.
Well, you're motivated, but I wasn't. So
that's true. Yeah. My informational field is different and it's just simpler for me because, you know, breastfeeding solves so many problems. Baby doesn't want to sleep, breastfeed. Baby cries, breastfeed. Baby's bored, breastfeed. There's just such a baby sick, breastfeed. Baby's throwing up, breastfeed.
But it also means that your body's on call still.
Yeah, but then, you know, there's so many benefits to long-term breastfeeding. You know that you cut down the risk of having breast cancer by, I don't know, 3 times by having, maybe my numbers are wrong, but you'd significantly reduce the chance of having breast cancer if you breastfeed for more than 2 years total within your lifetime.
Well, if you have 3 kids, that's not that
hard.
Yeah,
you're good. You're good. You're already past that. Yeah.
But yeah, I was done. I was definitely done. And I was like, you know what? You're going to live.
Yeah. But if you don't have the right support around you, because the thing is with attachment parenting, and I saw a post on this today, which was funny because we were talking about this today. It was saying that, you know, attachment parenting is great when you have a village. You need to have that support around you for you to be able to be with your baby body and mind, for people to take care of you. Because otherwise, it's mission impossible, especially, you know, doing the Olympic sport of being a mother, expat mother here in Luxembourg.
What do you want people to know about the fourth trimester?
The thing about the fourth trimester is that everybody thinks about birth, but very little people don't really think about what happens next.
Mm-hmm.
And the more you know, the better you're prepared. The more realistic you are about the amount of help you need to get, the better it will go. Because if you know that what you want to do ideally in your fourth trimester is rest in bed. The more time you spend horizontal, the more chances your body has to put things back in their own place. The more you have bonding time with the baby, skin to skin in bed, the better your breastfeeding journey will be, the better your hormones will be. And people don't plan for that. They're like, oh, I'll be home and I'll be cooking and I'll be cleaning. And that, yes, my husband will help. No, get somebody to cook every day. Get somebody to clean every day. Get your husband on a list of things he needs to do every day without you reminding him.
Yeah, totally.
That's a big thing nobody thinks about.
And also, don't go back to work so soon.
So soon, yeah. That's also cultural.
I think there's like you get a year here though.
You get up to 9 months, yeah. You get either 3 months and then you have a choice to prolong it up to 9 months. You get less pay, but you get that. Because in France and in the US, you know that you don't get anything. I mean, you get
six weeks.
6 weeks, which is nothing.
Yeah, yeah.
It's ridiculous.
Okay, so if someone decides that they do want a doula and they are concerned about the fourth trimester, how can they find you?
Yeah, so we do mama meets twice a month. We do them in the city center and it's called the New Mamas Club. We call it the New Mamas Club, but any mama is welcome no matter what their baby's age is. And we talk about things, how to make their life easier and just talk, because that's a big part of postpartum, talking to other women.
Is there an Instagram page or a Facebook page?
Yeah, so I'm Mama Leopard, mama.leopard.
Nice.
Yeah, because, well, you know, I used to love leopard print. I mean, I still do love leopard print and I'm a mother. So why does one have to cancel out the other?
Great. Okay. So find you at Mama Leopard.
Mama Leopard. Yeah. And we put the dates. I have all the dates in my header and my Instagram page.
Okay.
And we run these meets. So come over or text me or DM for any support that you'd like. We also run birth circles together with another doula where we talk about birth in Luxembourg specifically.
Okay.
We spent over 2 hours talking only about birth. So we get, you know, if you have given birth here in Luxembourg, come tell your story.
Oh, that's cool.
If you're pregnant, come listen to other stories. And we talk about the conditions here, which are not bad, but you have to know the system to, in order to be able to play it the way you want to. And we've been doing this for 4.5 years now, so we've collected a lot of knowledge around that.
Very cool. All right.
Yeah.
Paulina, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. I'm so excited.
And that's a wrap on this episode of Mom Life in Luxembourg. If you like the show, I'd love to hear from you. Please feel free to leave a comment, or better yet, share with another mom friend. And if there's a topic you'd like to see covered or you want to be on the show yourself, please email me at momlife@rtl.lu. And if you're feeling social, you can always reach me on Facebook and Instagram at Mom Life in Luxembourg. Thanks so much and have a great day.